Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. So if you spend enough time working on the past, whether you're focused on stuff that happened just a few years back or 10,000 years ago, you're going to have to get used to the idea that you can't know everything. There are going to be gaps and missing pieces. Maybe the person who wrote down the only existing account of a conflict was lying about it for reasons that are lost to us. Maybe an ancient society exposed its dead to the elements rather than burying them for us to conveniently find. The body is one of those things that can be really hard for us to understand and appreciate in the past, and our skin most of all. But just because it almost never survives does not mean it didn't matter. Very much the opposite. New work is helping us understand just how important a role the body and our skin played in our past, especially through the practice of tattooing. That is why I'm so stoked to talk to our guest today. His work is cutting edge and super cool, and it's opening up whole new windows onto the human past. He's a prehistoric archaeologist for the state of Tennessee's Division of Archaeology, where he manages ancient Native American sites on state-owned lands and conducts archaeological excavations and research. He's published widely on a variety of topics, and he is one of the world's leading experts on the archaeological study of tattooing. Aaron Dieter Wolf, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
So let's start with tattooing. Given that skin so rarely survives in the archaeological record, how can we even start to wrap our heads around tattooing in the past?
Well, it's hard to do that, right? And that's one of the reasons why this is sort of an emerging field of study. It's not until fairly recently that there has been, I think, this coming together of both interest in the scientific community and then also technologies with which we can better look at and understand these practices in the past. You know, aside from the tattooed bodies themselves, there are basically a couple lines of evidence that we can use. The first is the historical record, what people have written down about their own culture, about other cultures. As a subset of that, there's the artistic record. And that, of course, goes back earlier than the written word, you know, back to Ice Age art in Europe and even earlier, how people depicted their own bodies or the bodies of beings who may or may not be human, depending on how we interpret these things. And then the last line of evidence is the actual artifact record, the tools of the practice, and learning to identify those.
So how can you identify those specific tools? Because in reading through some of your work, you see things like needles, you see things that might be labeled as an awl or a bone needle when it's picked up in a site. If you don't know that you're looking for a tattooing implement, how can you tell? Are there specific designs, or does it need to look at things like residue patterns, use wear analysis? Like, what's going to tell you that that object is used for tattooing?
It's got to be multiple lines of evidence, right? And I think this is true of any sort of archaeology. You know, if you're going to pull one thing, particularly one artifact out of the archaeological record and say, based on this artifact, I think these people in the past were doing X, Y, and Z. The more lines of evidence you can bring to that statement, the better it is and the more responsible it is and the better it will probably hold up over time. And so, you know, when we're looking at possible tattooing implements in the archaeological record, this is actually the question that first got me interested in this research. Was this realization that when you look at the historical record, there are cultures all over the world who tattooed historically. But then when you turn to the archaeological record of those same cultures, it's very rare to find artifacts that have been identified as tattooing tools. And so that sort of is what spurred me down this research rabbit hole, is this question of, well, why are we missing that? And how can we do better in that regard? And what are strategies we can use? And for my money, the two best ways to do that are contextual analysis, right? So the idea of ideally being able to pull an artifact from the archaeological record and talk not just about that specific artifact, but also where it was in the site, the artifacts that are around it, you know, the position in the dirt. All of these things contribute to understanding how that artifact may have been actually used. And so it's a lot easier to do that, for example, using things that are excavated today by modern science rather than things that have been sitting in museum collections for a century or more. You don't have that contextual information anymore. And the second way that we've been working a lot with recently is microwear analysis, is the idea that when artifacts are used or were used in the past, whatever they were used for left behind microscopic wear signatures on the business end, be it on, you know, the edge of a stone blade that was used to cut grasses, or the edge of a stone blade that was used to butcher flesh, or on a bone, a pointed bone that was used to make basketry. And we found through, you know, a couple decades of archaeological science that those wear patterns are different on a tool that was used, for example, to make basketry than a tool that was used to pierce flesh. And we can even refine that further. So if you want to talk about like bone awls, you mentioned, you know, basically sharpened bone tools from the archaeological record. By looking at the microscopic wear signatures, you can tell when one of those tools was used to pierce dry hide. So in other words, for making clothing or sewing purposes, or perhaps, you know, more recent historical, something like cobbling, putting together shoes, versus if one of those tools was used to repeatedly pierce soft, fresh flesh. And both the patterns themselves and the extent of those patterns on the tool are different. And so by looking at them closely enough, we're building this comparative data where we can then take that evidence and turn around and say, this best matches tattooing as opposed to decorating pottery or, you know, shucking corn or something like this.
That's so fascinating for a whole bunch of different reasons, not least because it raises questions about how we've identified all sorts of artifacts in the past, not just artifacts that may have been used for tattooing, but it shows us just how much our own biases and understanding of what we're expecting to find influence the way that we understand what comes out of a site, what we see in the ground.
Yeah, it's our experience, you know, our modern experience and our own biases and how we live in our modern world impacts how we look at the past. And so I think, you know, there's definitely been this practice in archaeology of calling things what we think they are. And in some cases, those identifications might be better than others. But ultimately, you have to sort of be willing to step outside those typologies and relook those tools using new techniques.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a fruitful line of questioning to bring to any sort of artifacts that you're finding. I mean, it's like one of the really famous artifacts from early dynastic or pre-dynastic Egypt is the Narmer palette, which has all of these cool decorations on it and images that are redolent of like early Egyptian kingship. And that's what people focus on. But the artifact itself is a palette. It was like a larger ritual form of an artifact that was used to hold paints and pigments, probably for body decoration. And the form of the artifact matters a very great deal. That tells you a whole lot, just as much as what's actually on the artifact.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you know, this is an anecdote I like to tell. One of my good buddies and friends, Ben Robitaille, he claims he never said this. I attribute it to him that, you know, archaeologists 1,000 years in the future will pick up a flat blade screwdriver that we've dropped on the ground and think it is the perfect tool for opening a paint can. And it will go into the museum collection as being a paint can opener. And, you know, yes, it's perfectly suited for that purpose, but that has nothing to do or very little to do with what we actually today made and used and manufactured and distributed and purchased that artifact for.
Yeah. I used this example in a recent episode that I did that was like, if you were to dig up a person who was buried today and they were buried with their cell phone, would an archaeologist 1,000 years from now have any idea what that cell phone was for or how it was used or what the purpose of the artifact was? Or would you just describe it in material terms as what survives is like you've got a rectangular piece of metal. Maybe the glass survives. Probably not. Yeah. How would you even know? And that raises good questions for us about what we're pulling out of the ground.
Well, and the other X factor as far as talking about tattooing artifacts is, of course, preservation.
Yeah.
Is, you know, that when we look at the historical record of this practice all around the globe, a lot of the materials that are traditionally used to tattoo before the introduction of metal needles are things that are biodegradable. Cactus spines or plant thorns or you know, things like this that once they go into the ground, there's a very low chance, depending on where they are on the earth, there's a very low chance that they're going to preserve, an archaeologist will be able to recover a set of cactus spines. Now, you know, having said that, we were incredibly fortunate these last couple of years and actually identified a set of cactus spines that we think were used to tattoo. That was a testament to the quality of preservation at that particular site. It's not something that we can hang our hats on an everyday basis.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. What kinds of tools were used for tattooing? What kinds of pigments? Basically, how does what we can find in the archaeological record compare? You mentioned cactus spines, probably not going to survive. How does what we can pull out of the ground compare to what we know people have historically used for tattooing purposes?
Well, historically, when we look at this question, the tools and the techniques of tattooing vary according to where you are geographically, right? They vary according to the local environment, what plant and animal species are available, the culture and belief system of the group that's doing the tattooing. There's a ton of variation in there. And this, you may be familiar with, we call the direct historical approach, right? This idea that we can use historical evidence to hopefully project back into the past and better understand cultures that are no longer in existence. And sometimes we're fortunate that there are actually direct cultural connections between living cultures, indigenous cultures particularly, and groups that lived in the past. But other times, we're not so lucky. And so there's always this outstanding question as to how much can you really hang your hat on the direct historical approach. Now, having said all of that, one of the things that the evolving body on tattoo scholarship has revealed to us is that one size does not fit all when it comes to pigments or to tools that are used to mark the skin. There's a wide variety. There's different varieties of techniques, both how the tools are put together, how they are actually put into the skin, you know, directly versus at an angle versus, you know, pounded through. There's traditions that, you know, I would argue fall under the umbrella of tattooing because their intent is to make permanent, culturally significant marks on the body, but may or may not involve pigment, and so might be more properly called scarification, right? And so, you know, just because pigment may or may not be involved doesn't mean that the significance is any less, or even that there might be some overlap in those tools. Now, there's been very few direct analyses of ancient tattoo pigments. And there's actually probably less than five, I think, have been done at this point. And they've had to sample that pigment out of mummy skins. That's where it preserves. So, for example, if you find a bowl in the archaeological record that has pigment in it, well, that might have been for body painting. That might have been for tattooing. We don't know. Whereas if you can actually sample it from a tattooed mummy, you have a much better understanding that, yes, this is legitimately tattooed pigment. And what that research has showed us, and I think this is backed up by the ethnographic and historic work, is that most pigment is black, and most black pigments are carbon-based. And, you know, how they get to that carbon is a series of different steps depending on the culture. You know, it can be soot collected from above a oily plant that's burning. It can be particular woods or charcoal that are burned and then, you know, mashed up and mixed with dilutants, with liquids. But that's not all. The other thing that we learned historically is that in every culture, there are then symbolically important or culturally important ingredients that go into that pigment that might not impact the final color, but that are important to the people that are using them. And that might be that they're using the charcoal of a particular tree that has importance to their group, or it might be that there are, you know, the chin fat from a corpse, right, or other certain esoteric ingredients they've been called that are mixed in to help with sometimes with healing, or with imbuing those marks with greater significance.
That's really interesting. And there's a lot to unpack there. And I want to come back to various aspects of that. But let's start with just like the ubiquity of tattooing. So in a surprising number of cases where soft tissue and skin does survive, we can see evidence of tattooing. It can be very difficult to see. Gebelein man sat in a museum for 100+ years before very recent analyses found tattoos on his skin. But in a surprising number of burials where that evidence does survive, we see evidence of tattooing. Does that tell us anything about the possible commonality of tattooing, or do you think of those kind of as random survivals? Could we do a statistical measure to give us some sense?
I think there's a little bit of both there. So I maintain a database that has all of the published examples of tattooed mummies that I've been able to find. And that is up to about 70 sites at this point from the entire world, excepting Australia. And there is a commonality in that I believe every single location on the earth that has mummies, whether naturally or deliberately preserved, also has tattooed mummies. So, you know, that's an interesting overlap there. But at the same time, it's only 70 sites. And, you know, when we say that out loud, your listeners might say, oh, you know, that's a lot of sites. But, you know, this morning we had 23,000 archaeological sites in Tennessee alone recorded. And, you know, so when you blow that out across the entire globe, that's not a great sample size to talk about the ubiquity of the practice. And that's a thing that has happened in some of the older scholarship where if you go back and look closely enough at the history, someone might say something like 30% of the people who lived in the Chimu culture were tattooed. But what that actually means is that 30% of the mummies in one particular museum collection that could be attributed as being Chimu had tattoos. Those are not the same things necessarily. So, you know, particularly when you're working with museum collections, it's harder to draw those overall, the sort of big picture commonalities, or look at the meanings or the distributions, or, you know, men or women, or what age people are marked at, or these sorts of things. And for that, we really need dirt archaeology to answer those questions.
Yeah, so to kind of build on that a little bit, Ötzi is the oldest example that we found at this point, right? So there was some discussion as to whether it was one of the Chinchorro mummies, but that turned out to be a misstating, I saw, based on some of your work. So Ötzi is the oldest. How far back past that can we go where you see we have really good, solid archaeological evidence for tattooing?
That's it. That is the earliest at this point. You know, there are going to be older tattooed mummies that are going to be discovered, or possibly that have already been discovered and just haven't been looked at using the right technologies yet. I have no doubt that that date is going to go further back in time than, you know, 3200 BC, which is where it sits now. The archaeologists have not yet made a convincing case for the presence of tattoos on older art or older tools being tattoo implements that have not yet been, cannot be disputed, right? That there's no question that this thing is there. And, you know, going back into the history, I mean, as early as the 18th and 19th centuries, you know, particularly in Europe, particularly French archaeologists were frequently pointing to Upper Paleolithic figurines and the markings on those bodies and saying, oh, well, they're obviously tattooed or scarification. But then that's this whole thing to unpack, right? Why? Why are they one thing and not the other? How can we understand how the people who made these saw themselves? Is this even a picture, depiction of a real human being? Or is it, you know, something bigger, something grander, something where these marks might not actually have any significance on the living human body, but might be important to how they saw the world or, you know, the cosmos in which they lived? So there's a lot of questions there.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
If you had to guess at it, just to move beyond the undisputed evidence for a minute, what to you is the most convincing case for pre-Ötzi tattooing?
I could sit on the fence and argue any of them both ways, honestly. And, you know, and that's sort of a thing. I think conceptually, you know, the earliest evidence for human body decoration goes back to the Middle Stone Age in Africa, right? So essentially, as soon as humans are biologically human, we start decorating our bodies. And you have these fantastic sites in Southern Africa where people are, you know, bringing in vivid ochre pigments from other places and processing them, grinding them to make pigment. And there's no evidence of those pigments being applied to the caves that they're living in. And so the assumption then is, well, they're applying them to their own bodies. And for me, there's a compelling argument to be made that as soon as people start decorating their bodies, well, if it's important to do it on a temporary basis, then it's going to be that much more significant if you do it on a permanent basis. And so very soon after that, I think there would have been a development of scarification or tattooing in some form or another.
So it goes a long way back. I was reading in some of your work that you think there's a good argument to be made for tattooing tools dating to the Magdalenian, so kind of very late Paleolithic, very edge of the Holocene kind of tools in Europe.
Yeah, and that's a very specific case. That's from the cave of Mas d'Azil. And those get trotted out a lot in popular tattoo histories. And it's this set of bone tools and pigment processing implements that were found in the 40s, I think, by French archaeologists. And significantly, those archaeologists didn't actually know anything about tattooing, like as a global practice. But because they had sharp bone needles and pigments beside each other, they said, well, these were possibly used to decorate the human body instead of, you know, sewing clothes or making hides or something like that. And from that contextual perspective, I think that identification stands up. You know, you do have sharpened bone implements, you have pigment materials, you don't have cave art in that particular site. So what are they doing with that pigment then? Other people then have, you know, rightfully pointed out, well, you know, you can't know. They could be decorating, you know, palettes. They could be decorating individual stones. They could be decorating the clothes that they wore. Those actual artifacts have then never been looked at for microwear, for evidence of their use wear. So it's not possible to put our hands on those and say, yes, definitely these were. So yeah, possibly, maybe, definitely, maybe, right?
No, that's, I mean, it's good to be cautious about these things, because one of the things that I appreciate about your work and the approach that you're bringing here is that you're bearing in mind a really wide range of possibilities, that we're talking about a spectrum of practices from temporary to permanent involving pigments and scarification, and that there's a lot of different ways to do this. We know from looking at the ethnographic and historical records that there are a lot of different ways to do this, and we shouldn't assume just based on our preconception of what tattooing is or what tattooing might mean, or even that kind of limited sample to which we have more direct access, that we can then project that back onto the past. There's a lot that could be going on here.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons that people didn't really get around to talking about this topic in a serious way until the last couple of decades, was because there were these preconceived Western notions, you know, particularly in the Ivy Tower, you know, academia, the elite circles, both in America and Europe, that had very particular paradigm and vision of what tattooing was and who did it and what it meant. So when it was brought up, it was often those ideas were projected back into the past. And, you know, a great example of that, Ann Austin, who's in Missouri, she recently discovered a series of tattooed mummies from Deir al-Medina, a site in Egypt, the village where the people who built the pyramids lived, right? And she has pointed out how when you go back into the historical literature, you find examples fairly early on in the 19th and 20th centuries where there were discoveries of tattooed mummies. But in the discussion of those female tattooed mummies, the scientists who were looking at them basically were just like, yeah, they were decorated for the erotic pleasure of the pharaoh, because why else would a woman be tattooed? And like that was actually like published science. And so, of course, you know, Anne then has been taking a much different track into this and looking at, well, what does that mean? What does it mean when women's bodies are marked? And you're finding connections to particular goddesses and traditions that are linked to, yeah, to female fertility, but also to agricultural fertility and protection of the household and protection of children and things like this. So it becomes a much more nuanced picture with our current understandings of, you know, the world and the practice.
So let's dig into that a little bit. What kinds of meanings do you think tattoos might have had for people in the distant past? I mean, do we have any way of knowing? What can the ethnographic and historical records tell us about that?
It can tell us some about it. You know, you brought up earlier the discussion of history and how, you know, whether historians are lying. And so that's always a big problem, right? Particularly when you find older historians, classicists, people like this, classical historians who are writing about cultures, again, that are not their own. And it's really important to interrogate those histories and look at, you know, who is this man? They're always men. Who is this man who is writing? Where did he experience or see this firsthand? Is he generalizing about an entire culture based on his visit to, you know, one small village on the English coast 5,000 years after the practice took place? You know, like you need to really sort of drill into those things. I think we tend to almost fetishize older historians and sort of have this idea that like Herodotus is truth because, you know, we learned him in high school and in college and, you know, maybe, but, you know, he also made a lot of stuff up and copied from other people and may never have visited some of the places he went. And so when Herodotus talks, for example, about why the Scythians were tattooing, the reasons he gives for that may be valid, but then can we project that even further into the past on the Pazirak mummies from Siberia, you know, who are not properly Scythian, they're pre-Scythian by a couple thousand years. And so, you know, can we then project these same practices backwards? It's really difficult because in most cases, no one thought to write it down for us. Right. So, you know, we know they tattooed in ancient Egypt, but we have yet to find that document that says we marked our bodies because X, Y, Z. And so, yeah, I think it behooves us to be careful then when we talk about why people may have been doing it in the past. Now, when we look at the historical record, there are certain commonalities that we find. You know, people are tattooed to mark coming of age as part of the rituals that make them adults in their society. They're tattooed to convey status, to confer status within the society, whether based on their own achievements, what they've done, how many heads they've taken in battle, or the achievements of their ancestors in some cases. But it same thing, it conveys status. Tattooing is done to confer supernatural abilities and to connect individuals to the spirit world, to animist forces around them. And, you know, sometimes tattooing is done as punishment. It's done as a way of othering or of marking someone as being not a part of a particular society. You know, so while we may have this kind of evolving idea that, you know, all cultures around the world tattooed for purely positive reasons, and certainly the tattoo community might be, you know, predisposed to see it that way, there's also good historical evidence from a number of places on Earth where tattoos were not used for that purpose and were used to mark exclusion from a society. Historically, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So I was thinking it specifically in the case of the Romans. I read a really fascinating article about this maybe 8 or 10 years ago that traditionally classicists have translated the word stigma to mean brand, but there's equally good reason to think that it meant tattooing. And in that case, tattooing was an act of exclusion. It was a thing designed to mark off particular segments of society even more clearly from the rest.
It was, yeah. I think it was Christopher Jones who figured that out, out that translation. And, you know, again, but that's not cut and dried, right? So we do have evidence then of Roman soldiers on the frontier choosing to be tattooed. And in that case, you know, it's not a, we can't then look at that and be like, that was the Roman Empire marking you as being an outsider. No, like you were stationed, you know, across the Roman wall from these naked blue painted people who, you know, who were literally dying to kill you. And, you know, you marked yourself with Roman letters or something. You know, again, the histories are a little vague there, but those are some really interesting instances, and we see those particularly in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Greco-Roman tradition, and then in East Asia, in what will become China and Japan and Korea, where sort of as a twist of history, the groups that ended up on top, right, the groups that ended up in control, they themselves did not tattoo, but many groups around them did. And so not being tattooed was a mark of being part of the Hebrews or the Han Chinese or the Roman auxiliary or whoever. And instead, then, those marks could be deliberately put on to people, to criminals particularly, in order to mark them as being less than human, which is how a lot of these groups perceived of the quote-unquote barbarian cultures on their periphery.
In reading some of your work, you made the point that tattooing today is a highly individual act. People tend to get things that have individual meaning to them. And that is not necessarily the way that tattooing functioned in the past, where tattooing could be a very strong marker of group identity. And there are cases where that's true now, but it seems much more individual. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the ways in which tattooing is kind of a traditional or group-oriented rather than individual-focused practice?
Sure. Yeah. So if we look again at this global sample of groups and cultures who tattooed historically, with the exception of those who were doing it as punishment, we see broadly that they are marks that are aspired to within the culture, and that they are marks that not everybody is eligible to receive because of an event or an accomplishment or a coming of age. And because of how these marks are used then within the society, because they confer elevated status, because they show someone has having a special relationship with the universe or ancestral spirits, these are things that a lot of people may have wanted, but just couldn't go out and get. And as part of that, in these cultures, we find that the people who were doing the tattooing, they were not doing it as commerce, as tattooing is done today, right? It's an exchange of goods for services. In the past and in traditional societies, the people doing the tattooing may have received payment in the form of goods or in the form of services because what they were doing was critically important to the group, to the identity of the group, but they would not just do it to anybody. And historically in the United States, there's actually some accounts of Native American tattooing in, I believe it was the 17th century or so, where an individual had put tattoos on himself that he had not earned on the field of battle And his community came together and actually flayed those off of him then. You know, it was considered that much of a big deal that he had done this to try to impress people, but he actually hadn't accomplished what was required of him. And so they were forcibly removed.
That's so fascinating. There's so many questions I have about that I want to follow up on. I'm never going to get to all of them. A big one is this, though, that all of this comes back to the idea of the body as a site of expression of identity, whether it's individual identity or group identity, the expression of status. And it's a good reminder that not all kinds of status and identity are reflected in kind of the visible material record, that people can carry status and identity on their body in ways that are really hard for us to see as we project backwards in time. But it's a good reminder that, you know, just because a society might look egalitarian on the basis of the artifacts that are coming out of the ground, that they weren't necessarily, that there are many different ways to show things like status.
Absolutely. Well, and I think sort of touching on that, then there's also this idea that has worked its way into some of the older literature on ancient tattooing, where people will look at marks on a given mummy and say, oh, well, when he was wearing clothes or when they were wearing clothes, those marks wouldn't have been visible. So therefore, they must not have been significant. They must have instead been, you know, acupuncture or medicinal treatments or just simply artwork, because they weren't always on display. And, you know, that is also not the case, right? Like, when you're fundamentally altering the outer layer of the body in order to connect, for example, with ancestral spirits, whether or not other people can see that on a daily basis is secondary to the fact that you went through the process to have that done. And if you project this into, for example, ritual behaviors like, in other settings, like the things happening on the top of the pyramid of the ziggurats in Mesopotamia, right? The populace couldn't see what was being done in the rooms on top of the ziggurat, but everybody went inside and the thing happened. And so they trusted that it was a process that was taking place. And I think, you know, the same idea is conveyed with regalia or with tattoos. Just because it's not visible on a daily basis doesn't mean it's not there and it's not important.
Well, or also that there were specific contexts in which it was visible, like a ritual context or while bathing, something like that. There are a lot of different contexts in which a tattoo could be visible and could have meaning, even if it's normally covered with clothing, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting idea, right? That then within this ritual context, the unveiling of these very important symbols becomes a part of the narrative. And so it's almost, there is that performance aspect to it as well.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
I want to talk a little bit about the variation that we see in tattooing. So we see animals on the Pazaric Ice Maiden. There's a ton of lines and dots on Ötzi, and there's animals on Gebelein Man. Does it make sense to think of tattooing as a single phenomenon, or is it a lot of different things depending on when and where and who we're talking about?
I think it's a lot of different things. I think there's commonalities in it, but as an archaeologist, the way I think about tattooing is how I think about containers or ceramics, right? It's something that is hardwired into our human condition. So whether it's something that was carried to every place on Earth from a common point of origin or not, there's no way we can know that. All over the world, people developed containers because they needed them to drink water and store food and cook in and this kind of thing. And so I see tattooing as being very much in that same vein, that it addresses a cross-cultural need. And so it was conceived in different places at different times, in different ways, in different methods, but ultimately it perhaps feeds into this human idea of asserting our identity, of signaling, of projecting who we want to be into our society. And as far as the different variations, you know, you're talking about the different forms of it, the animals that we recognize, geometrical patterns that perhaps we don't with our modern eyes. I think that also connects to this idea of perhaps ceramics, right? Every culture on Earth that makes ceramics, they have a different style that's based on their material culture, that's based on their shared aesthetics as a group, and on what they're using those things for. And so I think it's important to me when looking at tattoos on mummies and tattoos in the past to not just kind of wave our hands and be like, oh, it's decorative because it shows a deer. You know, we can't know necessarily what that figure meant. You know, the same way when you consider Ötzi's lines and dots, right? He has a series of parallel lines on his body, some of which are then crosses, but most of which are groups of parallel lines. I've got Ötzi's wrist tattoo on me. And, you know, there is this idea that his tattoos were applied to be medicinal or therapeutic. And some of them correspond with locations on his body where he suffered from muscular ailments, but others of them don't. And just because we don't understand what three parallel lines may have meant to him doesn't mean they didn't have symbolic value to him, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. There's the question of function and form, and there's a tendency to separate those things in ways that are not natural, right? That like function and form are intimately intertwined, not least because function is in large part, it's not something that exists outside of our conceptions of what function is. And so to separate those things with regard to any object is wrong, but there's no reason it shouldn't also be wrong when it comes to tattooing. And I mean, in kind of in a general way, one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by this is because for so much of the human past, people have been not sedentary and have not had a ton in the way of material possessions, but you still want to say who you are. And so like the idea of the body as the site of identity formation and tattooing being an incredibly versatile and meaningful way of marking that, it just makes perfect sense. And I mean, it's just a fascinating example of how we can wear our own blinders and that it can cut us off from this incredibly important form of meaning for these people.
So a couple of years ago, some colleagues and I published a piece on this cactus spine tool from Bear's Ears in southern Utah that we identified as being a tattooing implement based on, in part, the micro wear, the use wear on the tips of it. But in that paper, that's one of those things that we sort of floated the idea of is that, you know, we seem to have this threshold at this point for the earliest tattoos that fall during this Neolithic demographic transition, this period where the world is warming, by and large, forager societies are moving towards settling down into larger seasonal villages and ultimately into cities. So yeah, bringing up this idea that, well, perhaps as you start interacting with more people on the landscape and on a daily basis who you're not related to, your family doesn't need to know who you are. They know who you are. They don't need to see your fancy clothes or whatever. But as you're interacting with other people, that maybe tattooing and, you know, body decoration as a whole is one way to assert your identity in that new sphere of human interaction. Now, is that correct? No idea. Yeah, there's absolutely no way we can prove that, but it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because identity is oftentimes oppositional, right? Like you say, you don't need to say who you are if there's nothing against which to compare yourself. I mean, I'm fascinated by the example of the Mesolithic in Europe, where you have lots of evidence for conflict between groups of foragers and exceptionally violent conflict too. Like there's like piles of heads and stuff that you find in a cave. That's the kind of context where you might expect body decoration to be extremely important within a context where the material culture might be very similar from one group to the next, right? It's not like they're making vastly different projectile points. It's not like they're all using basically the same kinds of microliths. They're probably speaking languages that are relatively close to one another. But in that kind of context where you have relatively high population and lots of competition for resources, you might turn to something like tattooing as a means of showing that we belong to this group and not that one, that could be incredibly salient.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, to tie back in a earlier episode you guys did about the shell-mound archaic. So, right, that is one of these ideas about this archaeological phase known as the shell-mound archaic in the southeastern United States that connects directly, I think, to this period you're talking about, you know, the Mesolithic in Europe and these identities, the formation of the first monuments, is this idea that one of the things that people seem to be doing is creating markers on the landscape. As the population density rises, people need a way to signify this is my spot. This is where our resources are that we've been collecting for generations. And you can tell this because Grandpa is buried right there. But, you know, but also we are specifically connected to the landscape in certain ways. And body decoration would be a strong way to do that.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that in terms of markers on the landscape going with markers on the body, but it makes a perfect kind of sense. They're both markers of permanence. I'm thinking too of pre-dynastic Egypt and the emphasis on body decoration that you see there, you know, tons and tons and tons of implements for like spatulas for mixing and applying pigments. I'm sure there was tattooing going on, lots of palettes, things like that. But it's in a context of kind of a semi-nomadic society, but one with high population densities in a restricted area, and that goes along with permanent places in the landscape. That goes along with David Wengro, whom I'm actually interviewing him tomorrow for the episode that comes out the week after this. He talks about how cities of the dead came before cities of the living in this kind of landscape, and that would tie very neatly into that same kind of emphasis on identity formation, that you have a group, you have the spot where you come to bury your dead and to be at special times of the year, and you have special ways of showing who you are on your body that you can carry with you all the time.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think there's some historical connection there too, when you look at, again, this broad historical tradition of tattooing all across the world. You definitely see these, you know, these traditions where, you know, the marks on the face are literally read as a history of an individual's ancestors' accomplishments. So it shows who you are and where you're coming from to people who might not live with you or might not be connected to you on a daily basis.
My mind is absolutely blown by this. That's so cool. I want to ask about some work that you're doing right now. You mentioned in an email that you're working on tattooing in the Andes. So you're focusing on mummies that are in American Museum collections. What drew you to that topic? I mean, is there anything you can say about it as you're investigating?
Yeah, it's been sort of a weird side project that sort of evolved to be something more. I had gotten interested in tattooing in the Andes because pound for pound, there are probably more people tattooed in the ancient Andes than anywhere else on Earth, if we believe our sample of mummies, right? If we can read that the correct way. Dozens of sites, hundreds of individuals. This seems to have been a very important part of these ancient Andean cultures. Perhaps petering out and ending by the time the Inca took everything over, which is sort of an interesting side note. But, you know, for centuries now, people have been sort of waving their hands and saying, you know, oh, well, I went to this site. You know, the travelers with their steam trunks go to some site in the desert in the Andes and are like, oh, I brought home a tattooed mummy arm for my mantelpiece. You know, and there's a lot of that kind of thing that happens, particularly in the 18th and early 19th century. And a lot of those objects then find their way into Western museum collections. And a lot of them, you know, they become curios, right? A museum will have a box that's labeled tattooed mummy arms from Peru, but very little information about where specifically those arms came from, because the people who collected them, they didn't, you know, this was not part of what they were interested in. And so in looking at these cultures in Peru as a whole, I found that there weren't many people that were really talking about the intricacies of these traditions. Tattoos were being noted in passing, but nobody was really trying to drill down in a way to find commonalities in iconography, connections between the tattoos and, you know, the architecture or the weavings. You know, probably a lot of people recognize this stuff. I mean, you know, Andean archaeologists do some fantastic work, but it's at least at this point not really published in an accessible format.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so being that I'm in the U.S. And I was starting to play around with some alternative imaging technologies, with infrared photography and with image decorrelation stretch, D-stretch, which is a program that you use to see very faint rock art. That's what it was written for, is to bring forth very faint rock art images. And then looking at, well, you know, we know that there are these collections in the United States and these things are pretty much just in storage and not being worked with. Is there something important or worthwhile that we can learn from actually looking at these individual objects and by comparing them to one another? And so this is sort of then turned into an aside. I think it's worthwhile. I mean, I think, you know, I hear anecdotally that there are dozens or hundreds of small regional museums in the Andes that have you know, tattooed mummy parts laying around, and those have never been documented in a systematic manner. I'd love to do that.
I'm blown away by this in a whole bunch of different ways. It's so cool, not least because it's just like, this was stuff that had so much meaning to people. Like, you think about the meaning that people put in their tattoos today, there's good reason to think that it may have had even more meaning to people in the distant past, especially as, you know, markers of group belonging. Like, the idea that these were things that were ubiquitous in people's lives, but to which we have only the tiniest sliver of access, is fascinating and deeply appealing.
Yeah, it is a strange sort of thing in that way, right? This idea that, as you say, that this was a visible and daily and important part of the lives of people who lived in the past, but really until the last two decades or so, as archaeologists, we were just kind of like, meh, you know? And I think you see that a little bit, you know, like I think back to like museum dioramas that I saw when I was a kid, you know, those recreations of ancient life. And people are always mostly naked, but their bodies were never tattooed. And, you know, using the information that's available today, we can, you know, we would have a much different vision of that past. You know, another example I like to use is within a decade of the first Thanksgiving, there are really good historical accounts of tattooing of the Wampanoag people in that area. You know, their bodies and faces being marked with, you know, animal designs and things like this. But, you know, when you think about like the Peanuts Thanksgiving, right, that is not a thing that is happening at that table. And so, you know, for whatever reason, because there was a historical bias against it or because those sources just weren't considered, I think a lot of these sources are accessible now for kind of the first time. You know, that's been the great thing about technology, right? We can go on archive.org and look up a 16th century German document that when I was in grad school, you would have had to like, you know, fly to Germany and put on white gloves to look at. And now we can get access to those sources. And I think there's this proliferation of interest, but also of the available information that's helping us re-examine those pictures of the past.
I cannot wait to see where your work takes you. Thank you so much for your time today. This is one of the coolest conversations I've had.
Oh, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for the interest, for having me on.
Thank you. And is there anywhere where people can find your work or follow you?
Yeah. So I actually, with a couple buddies, I run the Instagram page Archaeology Inc., which is sort of dedicated to sharing random facts about ancient tattooing and body modification and a reasonable amount of myth busting.
I love the Archaeology Inc. page. I am a follower. It's so neat. Thank you so much for your time today, and I hope we get to chat again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.